Haldeman looked subdued. Woodward started to rise, wondering if Haldeman would slug him if he introduced himself.
"Leave him alone," Woodward's friend said quietly.
The couple walked by, engrossed in private conversation. Woodward didn't move. Kleindienst called the reporters at their office on Monday morning to apologize for the canceled breakfast. There had been an urgent meeting at the White House, he said cryptically. It would all be out in a few days. That evening, the Post's night city editor called Woodward at home. The Los Angeles Times was predicting on its front page that the White House would make a dramatic Watergate admission in a few days. One or more high-level officials not identified in the story would be named as directing or condoning political espionage and sabotage activities without approval from the president. Woodward made an emergency call to Deep Throat. The procedure involved making a call from a pre-designated phone booth, saying nothing, and then hanging up after 10 seconds. Woodward had to wait for almost an hour by the phone booth before the call was returned. No meeting was possible that night, Deep Throat said.
You don't have to tell me why you called.
The whole town is going crazy. What's going on? Woodward asked.
You better hang on for this, said Deep Throat.
Dean and Haldeman are out, for sure.
Out?
Woodward repeated, dumbfounded.
Out. They'll resign. There's no way the president can avoid it.
Could the Post publish that?
Yes. It's solid, Deep Throat said.
What should we do?
Woodward asked. Someone's talking. Several are talking. Go find out. I've got to go. I mean it. Find out.
Deep Throat hung up. When Woodward arrived in the newsroom at about 11 the next morning, April 17th, Bernstein, Sussman, Rosenfeld, Simons, and Bradley were in Bradley's office trying to figure out what to do next. Bernstein had just talked to a White House official who said the place was chaotic, but that nobody seemed to know what was going to happen or when. Woodward rushed into Bradley's office, blurting out Deep Throat's message. The others were stunned. It was solid, Woodward said. Deep Throat had been sure. They all realized that the House of Cards was crumbling.
Can we go with it? Bradley asked, staring out the window.
Yes, said Woodward.
But he was concerned that the story might delay the resignations.
Bernstein worried that a story in the Post might even kick the decisions the other way. Rosenfeld suggested politely that perhaps the reporters in the Post, as well, were overrating their importance. If Dean and Haldeman had to go, the president had more to worry about than whether the Post got the satisfaction of reporting it first. Bradley was recalling that he had been badly burned on a resignation story once, and the experience had left him with a healthy fear of the whole genre.
I wrote a cover story for Newsweek on J. Edgar Hoover, saying the search was finally underway for his successor at the FBI, he said. Moyers, Bill D. Moyers, Lyndon Johnson's press secretary, said, "We finally got the bastard. Lyndon told me to find his replacement." So that was the lead, without Moyer's name. The search is finally underway for J. Edgar Hoover's successor. Johnson, the next day, I think, held a press conference at which he appointed Hoover director of the FBI for life. And as he went in before the television cameras, he said to Moyers, "You call up Ben Bradley and tell him, fuck you." Well, for years, people said, "You did it, Bradley. You did it. You got him appointed for life." Bradley said he didn't know what to do with this one about Haldeman and Dean. He wanted to go, but was afraid of it. A decision became unnecessary for the moment. A news aide brought a piece of wire copy into the room. The president had scheduled an announcement for that afternoon in the White House press room. The reporters decided Bernstein should go in case the president agreed to answer questions from the floor. He called Ziegler's office. Bernstein didn't have a White House press pass either. The room was already jammed when he arrived. Bernstein was surprised at what he judged to be a very different attitude among the White House press corps, old and young. There were a lot of angry people in the room. Gallows humor was the order of the day. The president was running late. "He's out getting a cocker spaniel and a cloth coat for Pat," said one senior reporter, the remark referring to Nixon's famous Checkers speech in 1952 when he was running for vice president. In the speech, he defended his campaign finances and a secret fund.
"Nixon's going to waive executive privilege for Manolo and finally throw him to the wolves," said another. Manolo Sanchez was the president's valet. Someone theorized that they were about to hear the administration's prison reform message.
"Yeah," replied another. "They're going to move the White House to Leavenworth."
A few members of the press corps, including Helen Thomas of UPI, thought the president was going to announce Bob Haldeman's resignation. An hour passed, and the television lights were turned off. Jerry Warren appeared and said the president would be out as soon as possible. Warren looked grim. There was some discussion as to whether Warren's appearance meant that Ziegler was finished and going to be replaced. If the president admitted any White House involvement in Watergate, someone said, Ziegler deserved to be finished. He deserved to be finished no matter what, someone else added, and there was a good deal of laughter. Helen Thomas thought the president had become so emotionally wrought at what he was going to have to announce that he couldn't pull himself together to go through with it. That would explain the delay, she said. Warren appeared again and said it wouldn't be too much longer. The lights went back on. At 4:40 p.m., Ziegler, looking grimmer than Warren, emerged from the hallway in the West Wing. "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." The president was very tanned, but he looked older than his pictures. His hands were shaking, Bernstein noticed.
"On March 21st, he said, "as a result of serious charges which came to my attention, some of which were publicly reported, I began intensive new inquiries into this whole matter. I can report today that there have been major developments in the case concerning which it would be improper to be more specific now, except to say that real progress has been made in finding the truth."
There were to be no resignations that day. Instead, the president announced that he would suspend any person in the executive branch or in government who was indicted in the case. The president had become the investigator who would see justice done where others had failed. These were the much-reported major developments. Nixon had met on Sunday with Attorney General Kleindienst and Assistant Attorney General Henry E. Peterson to review the facts which had come to me in my investigation, and also to review the progress of the Department of Justice investigation. So that was why Kleindienst couldn't have breakfast on Sunday morning. Richard Nixon was now also the prosecutor,
and had expressed to the appropriate authorities my view that no individual holding, in the past or at present, a position of major importance in the administration should be given immunity from prosecution.
The president, reversing his earlier position, was now agreeing to permit his aides to testify under oath before the Senate Watergate Committee, he said. Though they might still claim executive privilege on particular questions, John Ehrlichman was working out the details with the committee. The president's announcement lasted about 3 minutes. His hands did not stop shaking. Most of the time he looked past the reporters in front of him, his eyes fixed on the television cameras on a platform at the rear of the room, or on the paper he was reading from. Then he forced a smile, more like a grimace, and hurried from the room. Bernstein asked some of the regulars if his hands always shook like that. Only recently, they said. The mood in the press room turned ugly after the president left. The reporters were going to beat and flail Ziegler into submission. At first, Ziegler's resistance was firm. There were no contradictions between the president's latest statement and what had been said before, Ziegler insisted. The previous statements from the White House had been based on investigations prior to the president's action, and on the previous investigation, and on information available at the time. Now, new information had led to the latest standing statement of position. But the reporters wanted more. On the 18th blow, Ziegler yielded. "This is the operative statement," he said. "The others are inoperative." For a moment, there was a splendid silence.
It was after 6 when Bernstein returned to the office and began writing. Any story about Haldeman's and Dean's resignations would have to await further confirmation. Ziegler had filled several pages of transcript, dodging that question. But Woodward had already written an insert that helped put the president's statement in perspective. He had been told by officials at Justice and the White House that several presidential aides would soon be indicted by the Watergate grand jury. Mitchell, Magruder, and Dean were the most likely candidates. They were not named in the story. When he read the story, Harry Rosenfeld gave Bernstein a good-natured look which said, "You should know better," and crossed out the reference to the president's shaking hands. The reporters began to search for the exact reasons behind the president's abrupt turnabout. The next morning, April 18th, Woodward called a man from CRP and asked him who was talking to the prosecutors. "Why don't you come over to my office about 4 this afternoon? I might have something for you," he said. It was a long, warm walk. Not very pleasant because the metro subway construction had ripped up many of the streets and sidewalks along the way. The sound of jackhammers and pile drivers was deafening. Woodward could still hear the noise outside as he sat in a chair across the desk from the CRP man. "Magruder is your next McCord," he said. "He went to the prosecutors last Saturday, April 14th, and tucked it to Dean and Mitchell." Woodward was surprised. He had regarded Magruder as a super-loyalist. "Things must have been very bad," he said. "Bad? Shit," the man said. "The walls were coming in on him. Walls, ceiling, floor, everything." He threw his arms in front of his face for emphasis. Woodward asked what McGregor had pinned on Dean and Mitchell. "The whole mess," the man said. "The bugging plans and the payoff scheme. Those meetings, or at least one meeting, in Mitchell's office when everything was discussed with Liddy before the bugging." Woodward took a cab back to the office and called a White House official. "We know Magruder is talking," Woodward said. "You got pretty good information, then," the official answered. "How extensive was what Magruder told the prosecutors?" "The works. All the plans for the bugging, the charts, the payoffs. This is no hearsay like McCord. It'll put Dean and Mitchell in jail." Woodward called Magruder's lawyer, James J. Bierbauer, and told him that the Post was aware that his client had gone to the prosecutors.
Now wait, Bierbauer said. "I'm not even confirming that he is my client."
Woodward said the Post was going to report that Magruder had accused Dean and Mitchell on both the bugging and the cover-up.
"I'll call you back in 15 minutes, Bierbauer said. Half an hour later, he told Woodward, "I will confirm that he will testify before the grand jury when he is called."
Woodward called a Justice Department official and told him what he had.
"That's not all." The official sounded positively cocky. "Other people will testify that Mitchell and Dean were in on the arrangements for the payoffs."
Bernstein reached a White House source who confirmed Deep Throat's information that Haldeman and Dean were finished there. Dean's resignation had already been typed out, and Haldeman's was in the works. Woodward was finishing the first page of the story when Bradley arrived at his desk. He had brought a sheet of his 2-ply paper with him and sat down at a typewriter behind Woodward. Their backs were to each other. Woodward heard Bradley say something about "the story I've been waiting for." Then Woodward heard the sound of the typewriter. Bradley's first paragraph was out in about a minute flat, and he asked Woodward to turn around and look. Woodward protested mildly that Bradley had failed to attribute the story to any sources. It read as if Magruder's allegations had come from nowhere and landed in the Post's lap. Bradley was undeterred.
"You can do that later," he said, and started typing again.
By the end of the third paragraph, he had more or less solved the attribution problem and filled the 2-ply. Except for titles, middle names, and initials, the 3-paragraph lead was Bradley's. "Former Attorney General John N. Mitchell and White House Counsel John W. Dean III approved and helped plan the Watergate bugging operation, according to President Nixon's former special assistant, Jeb Stuart Magruder. Mitchell and Dean later arranged to buy the silence of the 7 convicted Watergate conspirators, Magruder has also said. Magruder, the deputy campaign manager for the president, made these statements to federal prosecutors Saturday, according to 3 sources in the White House and the Committee for the Re-Election of the President. The entire story filled half of the front page, the most space ever devoted to a single Watergate story. The New York Times edition for the same day, April 19th, carried a 5-column headline on Watergate. Attorney General Kleindienst had disqualified himself from handling the case because of persistent reports that 3 or more of his colleagues would be indicted. Cy Hirsch had written that the grand jury inquiry had shifted emphasis from the Watergate bugging itself to the obstruction of justice by administration officials thought to be involved in the cover-up. John Dean was said to be ready to implicate others if indicted. That morning, Bernstein called Dean's office. Dean's secretary was crying. She didn't know where her boss was, or if he worked at the White House anymore. She gave Bernstein the names of several friends and associates of Dean's who might be helpful. All were unreachable. Chapter 15. In the late morning, when Dean's secretary had regained her composure, she called back and read Bernstein a statement that had been issued in Dean's name. "To date, I have refrained from making any public comment whatsoever about the Watergate case. I shall continue that policy in the future. It is my hope, however, that those truly interested in seeing that justice is done will be careful in drawing any conclusions as to the guilt or involvement of any person. Finally, some may hope or think that I will become a scapegoat in the Watergate case. Anyone who believes this does not know me, know the true facts, nor understand our system of justice." Bernstein read the statement twice. A threatening, defiant John Dean was something new. He called the White House press office to check the statement. The White House would have no comment on unauthorized statements by John Dean. The Post's White House reporter, Carol Kilpatrick, called Bernstein from the White House press room. Ziegler, in his daily news conference, had made no effort to defend Dean. The president's counsel was in his office, attending to business of some sort. The president was searching for the truth, not scapegoats. Bernstein reached a friend of Dean's whom he had talked to once before. Their previous conversation, brief and unfriendly, seemed forgotten. Now, Bernstein was told, "The truth of the matter is fairly long and broad, and it goes up and down, higher and lower. You can't make a case that this was just John Mitchell and John Dean. If Jeb's saying John Dean had prior knowledge of the bugging, John has a different story. John welcomes the opportunity to tell his side of the story to the grand jury. He's not going to go down in flames for the activities of others." The friend wouldn't say which others, but the message, loud and clear, confirmed that those who had once served Richard Nixon as one and had forged the superstructure of rigid White House discipline and self-control were in open warfare with one another. Bernstein reached one of the associates suggested by Dean's secretary. The man sounded cordial when Bernstein introduced himself. Bernstein decided to make a proposal. "The Post had been very rough on John Dean," he said, "but the facts had justified it. Now the case was blowing wide open. Dean had been in a unique position to understand the whole of Watergate. Others in and out of the White House were obviously gunning for him, Ziegler today and Magruder yesterday, and were trying to discredit Dean before he could do them any more damage. If the Post knew what Dean had to say, if he would talk to the reporters, and if they thought he was telling the truth, the paper could foil the attacks. But only with facts. The reporters had enough sources to check out his allegations and substantiate them. It could work to Dean's advantage. Unless he lied." The associate said that Dean respected the Post's Watergate coverage. Just what they needed, Bernstein thought, an endorsement from John Dean. "Dean doesn't think you've been unfair to him. There's no reason for him to take it personally. Hell, he didn't take a step without somebody telling him what to do in this thing. He didn't make the decision to try to beat you. He was against it. He'd like nothing better than to sit down with you and tell you the whole story.
but that's not what he needs now. If he ever testifies, he has to be able to say under oath that he did not talk to the press first. That doesn't mean that you and I can't do a little visiting with each other. After you check out a few things, and there gets to be some trust built up both ways, we'll both know better where we're going. Not knowing what to expect, Bernstein asked where he should begin.
You might start with the P statement, the associate said. It took Bernstein a moment to realize that the P was the president.
Find out what happened on March 21st. Who it was that brought all those serious charges to the P's attention.
John Dean?
Well, I'm not saying who it was, but your thinking is on the right track. Check it out. It sure wasn't John Ehrlichman who walked into the Oval Office that day and said, in effect, there's been a cover-up and it's worse than you think it is, Mr. President.
That'd be a pretty good reason to make somebody a scapegoat if you were, say, H, wouldn't you think?
Haldeman?
And others? From June 17th on, John Dean never did a thing unless H or somebody else told him first to do it, including the arrangements for hush money.
Who else?
Let's see how you do with checking this out first.
What about before June 17th?
John Dean would tell the grand jury that, yes, he went to a meeting at which the bugging was discussed, and that he said he wouldn't have anything to do with it, and that he said anybody else who did was crazy.
John Dean seemed to have answers for everything. If Dean had been at that meeting, how did he explain the Dean report? And the president's assurance that Dean and his report had convinced the president that his close aides did not have advance knowledge of the bugging.
The so-called report of the investigation was more or less whole cloth, a concept or a theory that was passed on to the P.
By whom?
Not John Dean. He had never even discussed Watergate with the P as of August 29th.
Then what was the report?
God damn, I thought you guys were supposed to be smart, he laughed. There never was a report. Dean was asked to gather certain facts. The facts got twisted around to help some other people above him. Now those people plan to cut their losses and shore up by implicating John Mitchell and John Dean. It's wishful thinking on their part if they think they can get away with that.
Why didn't Dean go public right away if he was so interested in the truth?
One, because nobody would believe him if he walked out today and said everything he knows. This didn't start with Watergate. It was a way of life at the White House. He's got to establish gradually that he's reliable, that he won't lie, because he knows things that nobody else is ever going to talk about willingly. Almost everything can be checked out, but before he goes public, he's got to convince everybody, the prosecutors, the press, and Senator Sam's people on the Hill, that he's telling the truth. Otherwise, the White House will cut his balls off before he has a chance.
Which was why John Dean was willing to do business with the Washington Post, correct?
Look, you asked me the right questions and I gave you some leads. The Washington Post isn't about to go out on a limb for John Dean. Check it out and we'll visit again tomorrow.
Bernstein didn't know what to think. Of all the Watergate principals, he probably had the least regard for John Dean. At least John Mitchell was his own man. Colson's intellect was first rate, somebody to respect at the poker table, regardless of what you thought of him. Haldeman was an enigma, sometimes brilliant, often pitifully short-sighted, often cruel, sometimes appealingly human. But Dean hadn't seemed to have any substance, a wasp Sammy Glick, who hadn't even been very imaginative about the way he climbed to the top. On the other hand, Dean would be the kind Haldeman would rely on and then cut loose. He had to know a lot. Bernstein called back Dean's associate. What he was going to ask was unusual, but it might be a good test of how straightforward the man was going to be. Bernstein asked him why he should trust him, who his friends were, whom he had worked with, his politics, how he had come to know John Dean, why he was convinced Dean was telling the truth. Who didn't like him, and even what he did in his spare time? They talked for more than half an hour, and Bernstein found himself answering a few questions about himself. The man sounded like somebody he would like,
And it developed they had a mutual acquaintance, somebody whose judgment Bernstein respected. He called the acquaintance. John Dean's friend came highly recommended, especially with regard to honesty and trustworthiness. Behaving like a scoutmaster had left Bernstein feeling a little preposterous, but relieved. If Woodward or he could now find someone else to whom Dean had made the same allegations, they could write the story. Woodward called the man from CRP. Not only had Dean told him all the same things, but he had first-hand knowledge of some of the allegations. There never was any investigation by the president until John Dean told him everything that day, March 21st, he said. Dean had been just a runner in the cover-up. There was virtually nothing about the cover-up, including the payments to the conspirators, which Haldeman hadn't approved. And Dean wanted to tell everything to the grand jury if he could arrange a deal with the prosecutors. Bernstein called the first friend of Dean's he had talked to briefly earlier that afternoon. Dean had told him the same story. Bradley was uneasy about printing allegations that Dean wasn't willing to make publicly or confirm personally. The reporters, with help from Rosenfeld and Sussman, tried to convince him that they were too important to ignore. Dean's scapegoat statement made little sense otherwise. They recounted the precautions they had taken. But Bradley's final decision was based primarily on something they had all forgotten about. Deep Throat's call to Woodward. If Haldeman was out, said Bradley, he had to be in so much trouble that the president could no longer afford to protect him.
Okay, he said.
The same morning the Post reported John Dean's charges, the headline in the New York Times signaled that John Mitchell's blithe dismissals of his own complicity had ended. Only a few days earlier, when Jeb Magruder's allegations had appeared in the Post, Mitchell had said, "This gets a little sillier as it goes along, doesn't it? I've had a good night's sleep, and haven't heard any of this nonsense." Now the Times reported Mitchell had told friends that in three meetings during 1972, he had listened to proposals to bug the Democrats and had rejected the plans on each occasion. Dean, too, had rejected the idea, Mitchell had told these friends. But he had his doubts about Jeb Magruder. For reporters, the new game in town was to find an associate or friend of a Watergate player who would anonymously disclose his principal's version of events. That morning, Bernstein reached a Mitchell associate who confirmed the Times account. Mitchell was due to appear before the Watergate grand jury at 12:30 p.m. Bernstein asked about his state of mind. "For a ruined man, he's holding up very well," the associate said. "He's resigned to the likelihood that he's going to jail. He can't go out because of the press. That's the main problem. He just sits in the apartment all day watching television or working on his defense. He hits the sauce every once in a while, but nothing serious. He's still got all his marbles. Martha yells at him all day long that he ought to take every damn one of them down, including Nixon. Anything he knows about the president being involved, though, he's keeping to himself. He says the answer is no. But that would be his answer regardless. He's too proud to even call Nixon, much less ask him for help or advice. That's for Haldeman and Ehrlichman to do, he says. He'll stay loyal no matter what it costs him, or how much he hates the others.
Which others?
Ehrlichman more than anybody. Haldeman. And Colson, too, but that's a little different. He thinks Colson's crazy. All those insane schemes to booby-trap anybody who shows up on the 6 o'clock news criticizing Nixon. Ehrlichman and Haldeman he hates for different reasons, and a lot more. He thinks they ruined the president, poisoned his mind, especially Ehrlichman. A lot of it's personal because they shut him off from Nixon. He maintains they were out to get him for months, and that Watergate was just the excuse they were waiting for. Plus Martha. Somehow Pat, Nixon, got in on the act, too, he says. Back in January or so when she smelled liquor on his breath at a ceremony. Hans and Fritz, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, got wind of it. And all three were jumping on the poor guy's back, telling the president he had to go.
Mitchell, grayer and thinner, left the grand jury room shortly after 3 o'clock and met outside the federal courthouse with reporters. For the first time, he publicly acknowledged attending meetings at which plans to bug the Democrats were discussed when he was attorney general.
I have heard discussions of such plans. They've always been cut off by me at all times, and I would like to know who it was that kept bringing them back and back. The electronic surveillance was turned down and turned down, and that was disposed of. He had approved an entire intelligence gathering program aimed at obtaining every bit of information that you could about the opposing candidates and their operations.
Through wiretapping? He was asked again.
No. Wiretapping is illegal, as you know, and we certainly were not authorizing any illegal activities.
Woodward called another Mitchell associate, whom he knew to be reliable. The man said Mitchell had told the grand jury that he approved paying the 7 original Watergate conspirators with CRP funds. But he had insisted under oath that the money was intended to pay the conspirators' legal fees, not to buy their silence. He had testified that he vetoed the bugging proposal for the third and final time during a meeting with Magruder in Key Biscayne. He believed Magruder had gone over his head and obtained approval for the Watergate operation from somebody at the White House.
Who?
He thinks it was Colson, but he didn't mention any names to the grand jury. He's got no hard evidence. Bernstein was still in pursuit of Dean. Dean's associate said over the phone that Dean had squirreled away documentary evidence, which would, among other things, establish the involvement of his superiors in both the bugging and the cover-up. Up to now, John Dean has been a true blue soldier for the White House, and now the White House has decided they can send him up the river for being a good soldier. Well, he's going to take some lieutenants and captains with him. A lawyer involved in the case told Bernstein he had seen Chuck Colson in the U.S. Attorney's office that afternoon of Friday. Woodward was able to establish that Colson had turned over documents from his files implicating John Dean in the cover-up. Things were happening fast. Bernstein was handed Jack Anderson's latest Sunday column. Anderson was getting grand jury transcripts and printing excerpts verbatim. Gordon Strachan, Haldeman's political aide, had testified that immediately after the election, Haldeman had ordered him to turn over to Fred LaRue $350,000 in CRP funds, which had been kept in a Virginia bank safe deposit box since April. Now Woodward found a LaRue associate. It was payoff money, the associate said, added to the original $80,000 which LaRue had received from Sloan and funneled to the conspirators. A Justice Department official confirmed to Bernstein that the grand jury was operating under the assumption that both the $350,000 and $80,000 bundles in $100 bills had been used to pay off the conspirators. Haldeman had been cornered outside his office by ABC and asked to confirm or deny reports that he would resign.
I can deny them, he said.
Flatly?
Yes, sir. Uh-huh.
Returning a phone call from the night before, a mid-level White House official described the situation there to Woodward. Old loyalties shattered. Little work getting done. Confusion about who on the staff might be indicted. Who ordered what and who ordered whom. Who would resign and who would be saved.
It's every man for himself. Get a lawyer and blame everyone else.
The president had met with his cabinet.
We've had our Cambodias before, he said.
Then, accompanied only by Ziegler, he flew off to Key Biscayne. Bernstein and Woodward wanted to catch up on some sleep, and on Sunday neither arrived at the office until early afternoon. The newsroom was quiet, with only a dozen or so reporters there. It was relaxing. They read the Sunday papers. Hirsch, too, had the grand jury looking into the Haldeman-Strachan-LaRue transfer, as well as the possibility that Haldeman had received wiretap transcripts. They had written about the latest charge by Dean's associate, that Ehrlichman was involved in the cover-up. E was the action officer, not H, he had said. Haldeman and Ehrlichman had hired the same lawyer, who was also meeting with the president. News that would have occasioned banner headlines a few weeks ago was now simply mentioned within a larger story. Gordon Strachan had testified that Haldeman had approved the hiring of Donald Segretti. They had written a single paragraph on it. The reporters began calling around town, looking for associates of the three principal characters as yet unheard from, Coulson, Haldeman, and Ehrlichman. Woodward found a Coulson surrogate who sounded eager to talk. He was worried. John Dean got to Sam Ervin and the prosecutors on roller skates and tried to do a number on us. Among other things, he said he would deliver on Coulson if they come across with immunity. "What did Dean tell them about Coulson?" asked Woodward. "Who knows? I'm not so dumb that I think I'm going to convince you that Chuck Coulson is a virgin. He's no saint, and that place isn't the Sistine Chapel. But my man doesn't break the law." Instead of covering up on Watergate, he insisted, Coulson had tried to find the truth. Then he had sounded the alarm. Coulson went right into the president as early as December and laid it on the line. Warned Richard Nixon that some of his people were part of Watergate in a big way and had an organized cover-up going. He warned Nixon about Dean and Mitchell. The president said, "The man, Mitchell, has denied it to me. Give me some evidence." And there are two other people who went to Tricky and said, "Cut yourself off from Dean and Mitchell." Tricky wouldn't budge. It's too fucking bad if it makes the president look bad. He was told that John Dean and John Mitchell were betraying him. Woodward called a White House source. On at least three different occasions that winter, Coulson had told the president that he should get rid of some people because they were involved in Watergate. So had others. Most of the warnings focused on Dean and Mitchell, the source said. Woodward called Coulson. He denied warning the president about Dean or Mitchell or about a cover-up. What, then, had he told the president on the subject? "I will not discuss private communications between myself and the president," Coulson said. "Not with anyone. You, the press in general, with the grand jury or the Senate committee." A few minutes later, Woodward received a call from a second Coulson associate. "Don't pay any attention to Chuck's denial," he advised. He, too, confirmed that Coulson had explicitly told the president there was evidence that his men were involved in both the bugging and the cover-up. The associate said there were two reasons for Coulson's denial: to avoid acknowledging that the president was forewarned, and the fear that John Dean might retaliate by implicating Coulson before the grand jury. The White House had no comment on that Monday's lead story in the Post. Nixon alerted to cover-up in December. The next Thursday, April 26th, Bernstein made his daily call to John Dean's principal associate early in the afternoon. Bernstein again raised the question of what had happened between Dean's meeting with the president on March 21st and the president's announcement on April 17th. "I think we lost the highest-stakes poker game in the city's history," the associate said. Bernstein guessed out loud that the president had thrown in his chips with Haldeman and Ehrlichman against John Dean. "It looks that way now, but nobody will tell him anything for sure. He's like a prisoner." For a while, John was feeling very high because he felt they were all going to do the right thing. It was his understanding that an agreement had been reached. Then it collapsed, because the German shepherd said they didn't think they had to go to the doghouse with John Dean. Haldeman and Ehrlichman didn't think that they had to be indicted to save the situation. What exactly had Dean told the president on the 21st? "John went in and said, 'Mr. President, there is a cancer eating away at this office, and it has to be removed. To save the presidency, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and I are going to have to tell everything to the prosecutors and face the consequences of going to jail.' That was the gist of it." The president sat down in his chair stunned, like somebody had hit him in the head with a rock. Then what happened? He told him everything. Even gave him a list of who would probably have to go to jail. It was a very long list. John told him that the shepherds had known the whole story since the beginning. that he kept them informed of everything there was to know and carried out their orders, and that, from the beginning, they had told John not to discuss anything with the president, that they would handle that end of it. What was the president's reaction? Mostly he listened. Then he told John that he must be under a lot of strain. So he sent him up to the mountaintop to put his thoughts in order and get it all down on paper. John came down from Camp David expecting that everybody would stand up and say, "Yes, we were responsible, and the president knew nothing about this. We are prepared to accept the consequences and will cooperate with the grand jury investigation." But when John got back to the White House, it became obvious that the president had been persuaded by the German shepherds to keep his losses to a minimum. To sacrifice John Dean while trying to discourage the indictment of Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Instead of agreeing to cooperate, they're still telling the P that John should walk the plank for all of them. The P is ready to give John the final shove. Bernstein asked if Dean now believed the president was involved in the cover-up himself. "See what other people say about this first," he replied. "Then we can visit again." Woodward called his man from CRP. "Dean said in March he wanted to blow this up. Dean has attempted to be honest, but he was taking orders from Haldeman and Ehrlichman. Honesty and following orders were inconsistent, so Dean broke ranks." The reporters began another round of calls to the White House. Dean's version of the events since March 21st was surprisingly easy to confirm. The grip of fear that Haldeman and Ehrlichman had once exercised seemed to have been broken. Haldeman and Ehrlichman had acknowledged to certain of their colleagues in the White House that they had authorized widespread undercover activities and knew of payments to the convicted conspirators, but maintained that they had never specifically approved or ordered anything illegal. About 7:45 that night, Woodward got a call from a Capitol Hill source with an even bigger story. "The New York Daily News would be on the streets in a few minutes," he said, saying that acting FBI Director Gray had destroyed documents taken from Howard Hunt's White House safe. The documents reportedly destroyed had been in two folders. One contained bogus State Department cables fabricated by Hunt to implicate President John F. Kennedy in the 1963 assassination of South Vietnam President Ngo Dinh Diem. The second was a dossier stuffed with information collected by Hunt on Senator Edward Kennedy. The source said the news story was accurate. Woodward called a Senate aide on the Watergate committee. He confirmed the news account. John Dean had told Assistant Attorney General Henry Peterson about it 10 days before. About 9:30, the phone at Woodward's desk rang. "Give me a number to call you on," Deep Throat said. Woodward gave him the number of one of the main city desk lines. The call came at once. "You've heard the Gray story?" Deep Throat asked. "Well, it's true. On June 28th, in a meeting with Ehrlichman and Dean, Gray was told the files were, quote, political dynamite and should, quote, never see the light of day. He was told, quote, they could do more damage than the Watergate bugging itself. In fact, Ehrlichman had told Dean earlier in the day, 'You go across the river every day, John. Why don't you drop the goddamn fucking things in the river?' Gray kept the files for about a week, and then he says he threw them in a burn bag in his office. He says that he was not exactly told to destroy the files, but understood it was absolutely clear what Dean and Ehrlichman wanted. Before the Senate Watergate Committee, Gray corrected this. He said then that he had kept the files at his Connecticut home for nearly 6 months and had burned them with the Christmas trash in December 1972. Bernstein reached Dean's associate. "You ever hear the expression, deep six?" he asked. "That's what Ehrlichman said he wanted done with those files." The story was solid. Howard Simons ordered the front page remade for the second edition. Bernstein was more shaken by all this than by anything since June 17th. It was the language and the context of Ehrlichman's remark to Dean that troubled him.
just as if there were a couple of mafioso talking to each other in a restaurant. The president's number two assistant had said to the president's consigliere, "Hey, Joe, we gotta dump this stuff in the river before the boss gets hurt."
Howard Simon slouched in a chair, drawing deeply on a cigarette, the color gone from his face.
"The director of the FBI destroying evidence. I never thought it could happen," he said quietly.
In the late afternoon of April 27th, Bernstein and Woodward were called over by one of the editors to look at a story that had just come across the Associated Press wire as a bulletin. It was another Watergate. In Los Angeles, at the trial of Daniel Ellsberg, Judge Matthew Byrne had announced that he had learned from the Watergate prosecutors that Hunt and Liddy supervised the burglary of the office of Ellsberg's psychiatrist in 1971. Bernstein reached John Dean's associate for their daily conversation.
"Carl, how do you think they learned about that little bag job on the coast?" the associate asked.
"Dean again?
You asked the prosecutors who told him about that. John's got some stories to tell. Ask them about his credibility. Everything he's told them is checked out. And there's still a lot more that he hasn't told them yet, that they want to know about. Don't forget, John Dean was over there at the White House a long time, and there were lots of projects. John has knowledge of illegal activities that go way back."
"How far back?"
"Way back. To the beginning."
"More wiretapping?"
"I wouldn't challenge that assumption."
"Burglaries?"
"Would you keep a squad of burglars around the house for years if you only wanted them for one or two jobs?"
"H and E are upset about what has come out so far. There are documents."
"About burglaries?"
"About a lot of things.
You might think about the story of Patrick Gray destroying those documents. There's only one way this whole story will ever come out. You didn't see E run down to the prosecutors and tell how he broke the law. Has H been down there? I don't expect P to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue to the courthouse. That leaves one person. John Dean again. We are laying a foundation to protect ourselves."
"Haldeman and Ehrlichman have been trying to get John to take the dive and convince the P that he should save their skins and blame it all on John. The P has agreed."
"Is Dean going to implicate the P?"
"There were lots of meetings. The P was there. The cover-up was being discussed."
The next evening, Woodward went to the White House. He had asked a senior presidential aide for an interview to talk about John Dean. Woodward sat in one of the colorfully decorated offices in the old executive office building and drank coffee out of a cup bearing the presidential seal.
"Haldeman and Ehrlichman were finished," the man said. "And yes, it was coming. John Dean was going to implicate the president in the cover-up." The aide had a pained expression on his face.
"What did Dean have?"
"I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's evidence. The president's former lawyer is going to say that the president is, well, a felon."
The man's face trembled. He asked Woodward to leave. Chapter 16. At the office, Bernstein and Woodward discussed the statements of both men. They were convinced that Dean was going to implicate the president. Bradley and Simons thought it would be premature to print that. They wanted specifics, a look at the documents Dean supposedly had, Dean's recollections of conversations with the president himself, something that would enable them to evaluate whether Dean was telling the truth. Instead of the Dean story on the president, the reporters put together a Sunday story which said that senior White House aides had concluded that Haldeman and Ehrlichman were involved in the cover-up. The next morning, April 30th, word came in slowly. There was a phone call from Capitol Hill, then a tentative confirmation from a reporter at the White House. Bradley came out of his office to tell Woodward. "It's happening today. Four of them. Haldeman and Ehrlichman have resigned. Dean has been fired. Kleindienst has also resigned.
Elliot Richardson is moving over from the Defense Department to become Attorney General. Bernstein came in a few minutes later and Simons told him the news. He went to his desk and sat down. James McCartney, a national correspondent for Knight Newspapers who happened to be in the office writing an article on the Post for the Columbia Journalism Review, came over and wanted to talk to Bernstein. Bernstein said he didn't want to talk just then. Just before noon, the White House made an announcement, and the resignation letters arrived in the office and were Xeroxed. That made it real. The Haldeman letter referred to various allegations and innuendos, and the flood of stories which made it virtually impossible under these circumstances for me to carry on my regular responsibilities in the White House. Ehrlichman said that, regardless of the actual facts, I have been a target of public attack, repeated rumor, unfounded charges or implications, and whatever else the media carries. McCartney's article, which appeared in the July-August 1973 issue of the Columbia Journalism Review, recorded Bradley's reaction to the official news. It was 11:55 on April 30th, and Benjamin Crowninshield Bradley, 51, executive editor of the Washington Post, chatted with a visitor, feet on a desk, idly attempting to toss a plastic toy basketball through a hoop mounted on an office window 12 feet away. The inevitable subject of conversation? Watergate. Howard Simons, the Post's managing editor, slipped into the room to interrupt. "Nixon has accepted the resignations of Ehrlichman and Haldeman and Dean," he said. "Kleindienst is out, and Richardson is the new Attorney General." For a split second, Ben Bradley's mouth dropped open with an expression of sheer delight. Then he put one cheek on the desk, eyes closed, and banged the desk repeatedly with his right fist. In a moment, he recovered. "How do you like them apples?" he said to the grinning Simons. "Not a bad start." Bradley couldn't restrain himself. He strode into the Post's vast fifth-floor newsroom and shouted across rows of desks to Woodward, "Not bad, Bob, not half bad." Howard Simons interjected a note of caution. "Don't gloat," he murmured, as Post staff members began to gather around. "We can't afford to gloat." Bradley came through the city room, whooping, "Never," he kept saying. "Never, never, never, never." Bernstein and Woodward sat at the desks. Woodward suggested they take a walk. That night at 9, the president addressed the nation on network television. Bernstein and Woodward went into Howard Simons' office to watch the speech with him and Mrs. Graham. "The President of the United States," the announcer said solemnly. Nixon sat at his desk, a picture of his family on one side, a bust of Abraham Lincoln on the other. "Oh, my God," Mrs. Graham said. "This is too much." The president began to speak. "I want to talk to you tonight from my heart. There had been an effort to conceal the facts, both from the public, from you, and from me. I wanted to be fair. Today, in one of the most difficult decisions of my presidency, I accepted the resignations of two of my closest associates, Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, two of the finest public servants it has been my privilege to know. The easiest course would be for me to blame those to whom I delegated the responsibility to run the campaign. But that would be a cowardly thing to do. In any organization, the man at the top must bear the responsibility. That responsibility, therefore, belongs here in this office. I accept it. It was the system that has brought the facts to light, a system that in this case has included a determined grand jury, honest prosecutors, a courageous judge, John Sirica, and a vigorous free press. I must now turn my full attention once again to the larger duties of this office. I owe it to this great office that I hold, and I owe it to you, to our country. There can be no whitewash at the White House. Two wrongs do not make a right. I love America. God bless America,
and God bless each and every one of you.
The day after the President's April 30th speech, Bernstein was at his desk reading the New York Times and the Washington Star. A copy aide dropped a UPI wire story. White House Press Secretary Ronald Ziegler publicly apologized today to the Washington Post and two of its reporters for his earlier criticism of their investigative reporting of the Watergate conspiracy. At the White House briefing, a reporter asked Ziegler if the White House didn't owe the Post an apology.
"In thinking of it all at this point in time, yes," Ziegler said. "I would apologize to the Post, and I would apologize to Mr. Woodward and Mr. Bernstein. We would all have to say that mistakes were made in terms of comments. I was over-enthusiastic in my comments about the Post, particularly if you look at them in the context of developments that have taken place. When we are wrong, as we were in that case." As Ziegler finished, he started to say, "But..." He was cut off by a reporter who said, "Now, don't take it back, Ron." Bernstein took a copy and laid it on Woodward's desk. Later, Woodward called Ziegler at the White House to thank him. "We all have our jobs," Ziegler replied. Bernstein and Woodward had been sitting on the Dean story for a week. They hadn't been able to develop information on exactly what Dean was going to say about the president's involvement in the cover-up. On Saturday, May 5th, they had just finished writing a story about the mood of uncertainty and lack of morale in the White House when a long teletype message came from the wire room. It was a press release from Newsweek. Woodward assumed the worst. The news magazines put out a press release on Saturday night only when they had an exceptionally important story. The Newsweek story said that Dean was prepared to describe two incidents in the previous year that led him to conclude that Nixon knew about the Watergate cover-up. The first was in September 1972, after the Watergate indictments had been returned, and they had gone no higher than Liddy. Dean was summoned to the Oval Office by Haldeman and found the president and his chief of staff all grins. Dean quoted the president as saying, "Good job, John. Bob told me what a great job you've been doing." The second occurred in December, Dean alleged, when Ehrlichman told him the president had, in effect, approved executive clemency for Howard Hunt. Simons, Rosenfeld, Sussman, and Woodward gathered around Woodward's desk. Bernstein was out of town. Woodward said that he thought he could confirm the story easily. He called a senior White House aide. Reluctantly, the aide said that Dean had given substantially the same account to him. A little later, a senior Senate committee aide told him, "That's Dean's story, or part of it." The disclosure that Hunt and Liddy had supervised the burglary of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office had inextricably linked Watergate and the Ellsberg trial in Los Angeles. In the newsroom, the two stories were often referred to as Watergate East and Watergate West. In early May, Bernstein and Woodward decided to go with a story saying that two New York Times reporters' telephones had been wiretapped as part of the investigation of the Pentagon Papers leak. Months before, Deep Throat had told Woodward their names, Neil Sheehan and Hedrick Smith. But even now, the reporters couldn't find a second source, so the names weren't used. They did find, however, that there was a possibility that Ellsberg had been overheard on a tap. That figured since Ellsberg had leaked the papers to Sheehan. At Ellsberg's trial, the prosecution was insisting there were no taps involving Ellsberg. Now Judge Matthew Byrne asked the government to search its records again for evidence that Ellsberg might have been overheard on any wiretap. The new acting FBI director, William D. Ruckelshaus, found one. The logs were missing, but Ruckelshaus had been told by his aides that Ellsberg had been overheard at least once. Not on Sheehan's phone, as it turned out, but on the home telephone of Morton Halperin, a former member of the National Security Council staff of Dr. Henry Kissinger. Ruckelshaus's announcement that Halperin's phone had been tapped for 21 months was the first confirmation that the administration had used wiretaps to investigate news leaks. Moreover, it established that the government had illegally failed to disclose all its wiretap information to Ellsberg's defense attorneys. Several days later, on May 11th,